Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta, my amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading it together today on the Courage Handy Ham System CQ Magazine for June 2009. CQ Magazine is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address in lowercase, handyham@courage.org. We have a great website at www.handyham.org. If you haven't checked it out lately, you really should. We'll start off with ham radio news. K4ITL, W5KWQ, VY2MC, share Dayton honors. Wade D. Danny Hampton, K4ITL, has been named this year's Dayton Hamvention Amateur of the Year. In addition, the Dayton Amateur Radio Association honored space traveler Richard Garriott at W5KWQ with its Special Achievement Award and Copthorne Cop McDonald, VY2CM, as recipient of the 2009 Technical Excellence Award. Hampton from Raleigh, North Carolina, was recognized for establishing the Piedmont Coastal Repeater Network in the early 1970s. Today, the system links more than 40 repeaters in North Carolina and is heavily used for emergency and public service communications. Recently, Hampton also built a hospital-based emergency repeater system that ties together 10 hospitals via amateur radio. Garriott, a well-known video game designer and son of first ham in space Owen Garriott, W5LFL, was the sixth private citizen to fly in space. During his stay last year on the International Space Station, Garriott made over 500 amateur radio voice contacts, including many school contacts, and transmitted over 1,000 slow-scan TV images back to Earth from that station. Technical Achievement Award winner Victor Yankee 2, Charlie Mike, invented slow-scan TV. Did you know that? In the 1950s, and helped get the FCC to authorize hams to use it. McDonald, a 2007 inductee into the CQ Amateur Radio Hall of Fame, is also a prolific writer and a former CQ columnist. The awards were presented at the 2009 Dayton Hamvention recently gone by. AMPSAT-DL reports reflections from Venus. Germany's amateur radio satellite organization, AMPSAT-DL, reports successfully receiving echoes of signals bounced off of Venus on March 25, 2009. The group's president, Peter Gulzo, DB2OS, says the AMPSAT-DL team, working toward launching an amateur radio satellite to Mars, used a ground station at the Bochum Observatory to transmit signals, HI, H-I, in Morse code, to our closest planetary neighbor. The tests were made in preparation for AMSAT-DL's plan to launch a ham satellite into orbit around Mars. Edelstein to leave FCC for Rural Utilities Program. Federal Communications Commissioner Jonathan Edelstein will be going back to his roots in rural America as President Obama's choice to be the next administrator of the United States Department of Agriculture's Rural Utilities Service. Edelstein is a native of South Dakota and worked for former South Dakota Senator Tom Daschle before being appointed to the FCC in 2002 by then-President Clinton. When formally nominated and confirmed, Edelstein will assume responsibilities for all of the rural utilities programs run by the USDA, including telecommunications, distance learning, and telemedicine, electricity, water, and environment, and will administer some $2.5 million in economic stimulus grants designated for rural broadband development. Frank Bauer, KA3HDO, longtime leader of the amateur radio on the International Space Station, ARIS program, resigned March 24 due to a combination of personal and professional reasons, according to the AMPSAT News Service. Bauer has served as AMPSAT North America's Vice President for Human Spaceflight Program since 1991 and as International Chairman of the ARIS Program since its formation in 1996. Bauer currently serves as Chief Engineer for the Exploration Systems Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters and is working to develop the next generation of manned spacecraft. Senators seek, quoting, spectrum inventory. Senators John Kerry, Democrat of Massachusetts, and Olympia Snowe, Republican of Maine, have introduced a bill that would require the FCC and the NTIA, that's the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, to develop an inventory of every user of the spectrum between 300 megahertz and 3.5 gigahertz within 6 months. They say their goal is to produce a starting point from which to access the best future use of the radio spectrum. According to news reports, this inventory would include data on every government user and FCC licensee, the total spectrum allocated to each user, the number and types of radiators, and that's antennas, deployed, and contour maps showing the approximate location of each fixed station and its signal strength and coverage. It has no provisions regarding amateur radio, which is both mobile and frequency agile. I guess it is, huh? As yet, there is no companion bill in the House of Representatives. Well, hurricane season is coming. They want some help. Help wanted for the Hurricane Watch Net. The Atlantic hurricane season begins on June 1st. Guess what, folks? That's tomorrow by my count. And the Hurricane Watch Net is looking for help from new stations. The net operates in association with the National Hurricane Center when a named Atlantic storm is within 300 miles of land. According to the ARRL, net manager Dave Lefebvre, W7GOX, says the net is particularly looking for stations that can communicate effectively on 20 meters with Central America, the Caribbean, Mexico, and South Texas, even during the current sunspot minimum. There's a lot more information on that for the NET's membership on their webpage at www.hwn.org/home/membership-info.html. Possible threat to ham radio in Poland. Poland's Ministry of the Environment is reportedly considering new rules on exposure to RF radiation that, according to that country's National Ham Radio Association, the PZK, quoting, will limit the operation of Polish amateur radio stations almost to non-existence, close quote. In an open letter said to be on behalf of PZK, Wes Wasaki, SP2DX, says the proposed rules treat amateur radio stations on the same level as commercial stations, requiring field strength measurements and other measures. He says it would limit experimentation and set the maximum power level of 15 watts effective radiated power. Wasaki says the PZK was not consulted on the proposed rules, even though it represents several thousand emitters of electromagnetic energy. The letter also requests, quoting, help from abroad, from our companion amateur radio societies, the IARU, and individual hams, close quote, to write to the Ministry of the Environment on behalf of Poland's amateur radio population and explaining the differences between amateur and commercial radio operation. Well, folks, can you believe that? They actually want to knock down all the power to, what did it say, 15 watts effective radiated power? Come on, get real, guys. That can't happen to us, can it? I don't think so. And one more, CQ Worldwide DX contest breaks 10,000 log barrier. For the first time, more than 10,000 logs have been submitted for the CQ Worldwide DX contest, already the world's most popular ham radio contest. In addition, the number of CW logs have exceeded the number of phone logs for the first time in more than 20 years. There were a total of 5,013 single sideband logs, and 5,272 CW logs submitted for the 2008 run of the event, for a total of 10,285 logs. It is the first time since 1986 that more CW logs have been submitted than single sideband logs. The logs contain the call signs of more than 50,000 different amateur stations, making at least one contest contact. Complete results in the single sideband competition will be in the August issue of CQ, followed by the CW results in September. And there is an editor's note at the bottom of this page. Additional and updated information is available on the Ham Radio News page of the CQ website at http://www.cq-amateur-radio.com. For breaking news stories plus info on additional items of interest, sign up for CQ's free online newsletter service. Just click on CQ Newsletter on the homepage of our website. Time now for the CQ editorial, Zero Bias. The author is Rich Mawson, W2VU. Rich is editor of CQ magazine. He calls this one a paper tiger? Big question mark. Normally the term paper tiger is used to refer to someone, person, or organization who wants you to think he's a lot tougher than he really is. In this case, though, I'm referring to someone who makes you do so much paperwork that when you're done, you feel as though you've been mauled by a real tiger. That someone in this case is the FCC. In the past few weeks, I received two letters in the mail, each of which I should have been able to answer quickly and easily. But no, these letters had to do with dealing with the FCC. Between the two of them, I spent most of a full day tracking down answers and explaining one of them was so complicated that it became the subject of W5YI's Washington readout this month. The question number one was, that question from Dan Lemkin, WA2HMB, asks simply how one goes about filing a petition with the FCC. Keep in mind, as Fred points out in his column, that petitioning the government for a redress of grievances is a basic right of the American people guaranteed by the First Amendment to the Constitution. So I was really quite surprised in scouring the FCC website to find absolutely no reference to the process of filing a petition. The Commission has an excellent online system for filing comments electronically in response to petitions that have already been filed, but there is no way to submit a petition online, and there are no instructions on how to do so on paper. Apparently, the FCC wants petitions to be filed only by those people, read communications lawyers, who are already in the know. John Q. Public may have a constitutional right to file a petition, but the FCC sure isn't going to help him. We will, though. Be sure to read Fred's column starting on page 56, and then you'll be one of those in the know as well. Regarding question two, the second letter came from Warren Barden, WA2WQJ, an elderly gentleman who had been inactive for some years, but recently decided he wanted to get back on the air. He asked about getting on the air from his retirement community and about the possibility of operating high-frequency mobile. He also noted that he had lost his original license document, even though you no longer need a paper copy of your license. As long as you're in the FCC's database, you're legal. Most of us still like to have that piece of paper. So I printed out a reference copy of KA2WQJ's license to mail to him. I noticed that the FCC still had his old address in the database and wrote that he would have to update the records with his new address and went to print out a copy of Form 605 that he could fill out and mail in. What an incredibly complicated and confusing document. The package is 11 pages long, consisting of 9 pages of instructions, in parentheses, including one on how it is in compliance with the Paperwork Reduction Act of 1995, and another listing all of the official two-letter state slant territory abbreviations, and the form itself, which is 2 pages long. Part of the reason for so many instructions is that this quick form application is for use by licensees in 5 different FCC licensed services: ship, aircraft, amateur, commercial operator, and GMRS, the general mobile radio services. Actually, there are 13 pages altogether, since hams are also instructed to download Schedule D, 1 page of instructions and a 1 page form. Information and instructions for additional data in the amateur radio service, only to discover afterward that you will only need it if you are applying to change your call sign. But if you are applying for a vanity call, you need to pay a fee, which requires filing Form 159. That's the remittance advice, which is another 2-page form with 3 pages of instructions. Now, down at the bottom of the webpage from which you make the selection, you are told that for simple purposes, quoting again, you may retrieve all the necessary forms for the purpose of AUCADUROORWD only with FCC 605FS. Got that? Well, I downloaded his supposedly simplified package, and it was 21 pages long, and it didn't even include Schedule D. Well, if you're listening in the morning, it's good for a laugh, I guess, folks. Right here in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, at 6:27 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, on I think it's June the 1st. Granted, the FCC will allow you to file online if you have a computer and internet access. Oh, now we're getting there, which is not always the case. Oh, and both the ARRL and W5YIVECs will process applications for license changes using the much shorter and simpler NCVEC Form 605. W5YI slant VEC charges $8 for this service. ARRL provides it free to members and charges $14 to non-members. This service is available for non-vanity renewals as well as address changes and other administrative updates. Vanity renewals are also available at a higher cost. This sounds like a commercial, doesn't it, folks? Considering the complexity of the do-it-yourself approach of dealing directly with the FCC, I would say that these fees are bargains. Make use of these services. You will thank yourself for it. But the real point here isn't to promote the services provided by our friends at W5YI and ARRLVECs. They shouldn't need to provide these services. Dealing with the Federal Communications Commission on such simple matters shouldn't be so complicated that you need a third party to help you do it. Making a simple change, whether it's an address change, in parentheses again, remember, the FCC requires that you keep an up-to-date address on file, close parenthesis, I'm getting tongue-tied, or a routine renewal should be simple whether you are submitting the information online or on paper. Likewise, making it so difficult to know how to properly file a petition for rulemaking does not show a lot of respect for the Constitution or the people. Acting FCC Chairman Michael Copps reminded the Commission staff on his first day in the top spot that the FCC needs to become more responsive to its stakeholders. Not meat, folks. That's us. Steak. He's got a stake in us. One way in which the FCC can accommodate this goal is to make it easier for us stakeholders to deal with our commission, whether we're asking for a change in the rules or just submitting a change of address. It's time to tame the paperwork tiger. Oh, well. I apologize if I really got into that, folks, but it's early in the morning here. And isn't he got that thing right on, huh? Rick Mossom concludes his commentary with the CQ editorial page with a subtitle, New CQ Worldwide Contest Category. The CQ Worldwide DX Contest Committee has decided to create a new competition category. It's called the Experimenter category. The goal is to encourage participation in a contest by hams who are using technologies that don't currently fit into any of the other categories, such as split site operation with internet linking. The plaques for the two winners, one single side bin, one CW, will be sponsored by Tim Duffy, K3LR, in memory of John Kansias, K3TUP. Details of the new category can be found in this issue on page 32. That's the CQ magazine, June 2009 issue. And Tim's reminiscences about K3TUP can be found in this month's contesting column on page 106. Thank you to the CQ Worldwide Committee for all of your hard work in developing this new category, and to K3RL for sponsoring the K3TUP Memorial Plaques. It's 973, call W2VU, Rich Mawson. I think I'll insert here some announcements, most especially concerning special event stations for June. Several of these are dated like June the 6th and thereabouts, and you may yet not have received your recording of this program, so I apologize in advance if that's the case. W2CXV from Normandy Invasion, D-Day, and Museum Ships Weekend. That's in Oswego, Fulton, New York, ARC. It's on June 5. All the various frequencies, so look around, please. NC4ZO from North Carolina Aviation Museum Annual Fly-In and Warbird Display, Asheboro, North Carolina, on June the 6th. W5HUM from Lum and Abner Radio Program Commemoration, MENA, Arizona. It's the Quachita Amateur Radio Club on June 5th and 6th also. Special event call, N6R, November 6th, Romeo, from Commemoration of the Lives of President and Mrs. Ronald Reagan, grounds of the President Ronald Reagan Presidential Library and Museum in Simi Valley, California. Ventura County Amateur Radio Society sponsoring that. It's June 26th and June 28th. Should be able to get that one if you can get the West Coast from the East Coast, whatever. And we have a 96-year anniversary of the Transcontinental Lincoln Highway. It's called K0KBX and W0YL, celebrating 96 years on the Transcontinental Lincoln Highway, Story County Amateur Radio Club, Colorado, June 13 and 14. And in Canada, Victor Echo 3, MIS, VE3, MIS from the annual Streetsville Bread and Honey Festival, Mississauga, Ontario, Canada, on June the 6th. Also listed here are quite a few ham fests during the month of June. About half of them listed are the very first weekend, so you probably wouldn't get them anyway. But if you're driving around or have your amateur radio gear with you and it's workable and just want to see what we're talking about here, you could check on that in the CQ magazine for June 2009 on page 10. It's great stuff, especially in the summertime. You know, and as an afterthought of what I just said about checking on that on page 10 of the June 2009 CQ magazine, you know, CQ, as well as other publications, are available at most of the supersized bookstores, like Borders or Barnes & Nobles and others, I'm sure. So if you really want to see what some of these beautiful full-color magazines are like, you might want to pick up a copy or have someone pick it up and read it with you and discuss the illustrations, a lot of the technical stuff that's in some of the magazines, which I can't even touch on because it just wouldn't be feasible on a recorded basis here. But it keeps you interested in a wonderful hobby known as ham radio. So let's continue. I'm going to give you just a little bit of an article which is sort of titled, This is Jordan Calling, Juliet Yankee 6 Zulu Zulu, an American ham on the air from JY6ZZ. The contributing author here is C. Stuart Gilmore, call W1FK. My wife and I recently toured Egypt and Jordan. After visiting Cairo, Luxor, and the sites of the earliest Christian Coptic monasteries of St. Paul and St. Anthony's, we left western Egypt on a ship and went from the Gulf of Suez across the Red Sea into the Gulf of Aqaba to a St. Catherine's monastery in the Sinai, and then north to the southern border of Jordan and the port of Aqaba. This is truly an interesting spot. This Jordanian port is only a half mile from Eilat, Israel, the Egyptian Sinai, and only a few more miles from Saudi Arabia. It's less than 150 miles from Aqaba, north to Amman, the capital city of Jordan. About 3 million people, half the population of Jordan, live in metropolitan Amman. As one drives north up the valley from Aqaba to the Dead Sea in Amman, one comes close to Petra, the ancient hidden city, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Petra was first inhabited sometime between the 10th and the 6th centuries B.C. It is a fantastic collection of tombs carved into the cliff rock faces, and the tombs go on literally for miles. Petra was settled by Nabataeans and later was under Hellenistic Greek and then Roman control. While we were having lunch at Petra with Ibram, our guide, I asked him if he knew that one of the world's most famous ham radio operators was the late King Hussein of Jordan. The years of his life were 1935 to 1999, whose ham call was JY1, Juliet Yankee 1. CQ magazine recently remembered King Hussein and his operating station of Drake and Heathkit Gear in their November 2008 issue, page 84. When I mentioned King Hussein, Ibram replied that he himself had wanted to become a ham for some years and that he was just about to visit the Royal Jordanian Radio Amateur Society to begin his application for a license. In fact, one of his good friends, Mitty, it's spelled here, folks, M-A-J-D-I. I really don't know if I pronounce that correctly, but I say Mitty with the J being H more or less. Mitty's call is J-Y-5-D-E, was going to be in Petra that very day. Ibram called Mitty on his cell phone. Unknown to us, Mitty was only 50 feet away and began jumping up and down when he heard an American ham was with Ibram. Mitty's English tourists wondered why he suddenly became so excited. Of course, we walked right over and met Mitty. We're all pictured here. And made plans to visit the Royal Jordanian Radio Amateur Society when we got to Amman. The night before we left Jordan to return to the United States, Ibram drove my wife and me to the Radio Society building in central Amman, located adjacent to a huge sports complex with a soccer stadium and athletic arenas. There, we were warmly greeted by Mitty and invited in for tea, coffee, cakes, and cookies. Mitty sat me down in front of an ICOM 751 connected to a TH-7B Mesid Giron 14268 sideband. Call CQ from a Juliet Yankee 6 Zulu Zulu. I did so, and was soon in a pileup. A little later, we were joined by Rafik JY4CI and Elias HZ1EJ, who are visiting from Saudi Arabia. Magi and Rafi explained that the club became inactive after the death of King Hussein in 1999 and is currently being reestablished. Prince Raya, JY2RZ, is president of the Amateur Radio Society. There are some 250 licensed hams in Jordan, but at present only about 50 are active. Their general secretary, Mohammed Bilbisi, JY4MB, passed away only 3 weeks before our visit, and his death will be a great loss to Jordanian ham radio, as JY4MB had been a stalwart supporter of ham radio for many years. The club call, JY6ZZ, Juliet Yankee 6 Zulu Zulu, was issued in the early 1970s. One memorable radio event in Jordan was in 1975 on King Hussein's 40th birthday when the special call, JY40, was used. Plans for reestablishing the society aimed to seek out new members, especially Jordanian youth. It was certainly a pleasure for my wife and me to visit the Royal Jordanian Radio Amateur Society and its club station, JY6ZZ. I was pleased to make several new ham friends. Ham radio continues to be an example for world friendship. And now for the listener, at the very end of the article is a photograph of the late King Hussein, Juliet Yankee 1, JY1, at the mic of his personal station. Nice short piece about Jordanian radio. Well, we have another internationally flavored article here. If you're taking advantage of bargain airfares to travel to Europe, consider visiting Friedrichshof in Germany at the end of June for Europe's biggest ham fest. It's titled, Friedrichshofen, the world's most interesting ham fest, ? The contributing author is Tom Pereira, WNTP. The Dayton Hamvention is unquestionably the greatest of all ham fests, but after attending and selling at Dayton and at many hundreds of other ham fests during my 55 years as a ham, I finally decided to visit Europe's largest ham fest, Ham Radio, in Friedrichshofen, Germany. Turned out to be an absolutely fascinating experience. It was unlike any ham fest that I had ever visited. Thousands of enthusiastic fans had come from all over the world, and there was electricity in the air. The hundreds of flea market tables were stacked high with a variety of radio equipment that I had never seen in all my life of ham festing. After my first visit, I was fascinated, and now I go there every year. It is held at the end of June each year. This year it is June 26 and 28, in a huge complex of buildings at the airport in a lovely German town called Friedrichshofen, which is located in southern Germany on the shore of Lake Constance. Getting there is not difficult, with direct air flights, train connections, and easy rental car access. As with most large ham fests, there is a setup day on Thursday when dealers can prepare their tables for the huge crowds, usually numbering over 18,000. Friday is quite busy with perhaps 5,000 to 7,000 people attending. Saturday is the biggest day, but many of the bargains in the flea market are gone by that time. Many flea market dealers close down early on Sunday. The ham fest is divided into four major areas. I'll just give you the titles, not all the details, folks. Number one, commercial exhibits and dealers. They're all there. Number two, ham radio clubs and organizations and country exhibits. Number three, meeting rooms for seminars. Just about every minute of the ham fest is filled with interesting seminars and discussions and lectures on a wide-ranging selection of topics of interest to hams. Number four, the flea market. Ha-ha! For most Americans, the flea market is the most interesting, dramatic, and unusual part of the ham fest. The variety of equipment offered is the best I have ever seen. Much of the German World War II and Russian Cold War surplus equipment is worth the trip just to be able to see it and turn the dials. The prices generally are well below what you might expect, given the historic value of the items. A surprising amount of American surplus military radio equipment is also found at very reasonable prices. For example, last year a dealer was offering a 50-gallon barrel filled with PRC-6 walkie-talkies at $10 each, and by the end of the ham fest they were down to $5 each. This is the same price I paid for those historic American BC-611 walkie-talkies on Radio Row in New York City in 1953. American Collins and other military and ham equipment is also well represented. CW, or Morse code, is extremely popular in Europe for CW enthusiasts or people who are interested in the history of telegraphy and radio telegraphy. There are always at least 200 to 300 telegraph keys offered on various tables. They range from the beautiful and the very early European landline instruments through military instruments from all wars right up to the most modern paddles and keyers being made by artisans in various countries. With just a few $100 to spend, you could assemble a world-class historic exhibit of the evolution of telegraphy. In fact, you could do the same for the evolution of wireless and radio communications in many of the countries of the world simply by buying the offerings on various tables. Well, that's quite an endorsement, isn't it, huh? Well, now you might be wondering, well, what about operating your radios at the Hamfest? The CEPT agreement allows many U.S. licensed hams to operate their radios with no need for additional authorization. All you need to have is your original ham license and a copy of the CEPT agreement, which can be downloaded from the ARRL website. That's www.arrl.org. You will find lots of hams working simplex frequencies and transmitting on the local repeaters. Remember that the voltage in Germany is 220 volts AC and that you will need a round pin adapter in order to plug your chargers and equipment into the 220 VAC wall sockets. Check that your equipment will work on 220 volts or purchase an inexpensive converter. Much of the equipment you may buy at the Hamfest is wired to accept 220 volts, but many units can be rewired or jumped to accept 110 volts and may have dual voltage power supplies. Now, regarding the language, the prevailing language is German, with many British, Italian, and former Soviet countries represented. Virtually every dealer and ham speaks at least some English, though, so there is never a problem being understood. However, some of the heavy accents may make it difficult to understand an exact price of an item. I always carry a pad and pencil on which to write down the prices I am willing to pay for an item. Bargaining sometimes involves the dealer crossing out my offer and writing his, which I then cross out and write mine, and so on until we meet at an agreeable price. It is just like any other flea market in this respect, and bargaining is expected and usually very successful, especially toward the end of the Hamfest. A pocket-sized English-German-English dictionary will probably come in handy. So, folks, I guess I could say in summary, all in all, if you're looking for a different sort of Hamfest and your budget can support a trip to Europe, there are a lot of airfare bargains out there right now. Then a visit to Ham Radio in Friedrichshafen at the end of June can be a tremendously rewarding experience. Sounds like a lot of fun, huh? Here are a few results from the 2008 CQDX Marathon. In spite of no or very few sunspots for most of 2008, the 2008 CQDX Marathon was anything but quiet. Competition this year was very fierce. For the first time, the top two finishers had identical scores. Overall participation was up 10% over 2007, and the total number of countries available to work was up 3, from 298 to 295, although the winning score was actually 1 point less than 2007. A total of 191 scores were submitted, representing 39 countries, up from 2007's 34 countries. We especially thank all of our first-time participants for submitting scores. Now, what follows will be just a very brief commentary on the winners. The winner in unlimited class was OM3EY, Oscar Mike 3, Echo Yankee. The winner in formula class was UA3QUO, Uniform Alpha 3, Quebec Uniform Oscar. And a complete listing of all the results in the 2008 DX Marathon are on page 28 of the June 2009 issue, listed under call, class, country, zones, and score. Let's talk about that announcement a little bit earlier, that CQ Worldwide DX Contest adds a new extreme category. A new extreme category is being added to the CQ Worldwide DX Contest to encourage the development of new technologies in amateur radio communications in general, and contesting in particular. According to the CQ Worldwide Contest Director Bob Cox, K3EST, this new category has been established to allow amateurs to participate in the CQ Worldwide Contest while experimenting creatively with internet-linked stations and other new technologies that currently are not permitted in any of the contest categories. The rules for the new extreme category, as approved by the CQ Worldwide Contest Committee, follow, along with the more detailed explanation of how this scoring system will work. The new category is effective with the 2009 CQ Worldwide Contest later this year. Here's sort of the overview about the whole thing. A wide variety of new technology has emerged in amateur radio, including software-defined radios, remote stations, internet-connected remote receiving sites, multi-channel CW decoders, fully automated robot stations, and etc. Some of these technologies currently are not permitted under the rules for existing CQ Worldwide DX contest entry categories. For example, the CQ Worldwide rules state that, quoting, all transmitters and receivers used by the entrant must be located within a single 500-meter diameter circle or within the property limits of the station licensee's address, whichever is greater. All antennas used by the entrant must be physically connected by wire to the transmitters and receivers used by the entrant. Close quote. Now, this new category has been established to allow amateurs to participate in the CQ Worldwide contest while experimenting creatively with internet-linked stations and other new technologies. The rules of the CQ Worldwide DX contest apply regarding contest period, exchanges, and scoring. In addition to the basic rules, there is a long list of filling out details, one being entry categories, two QSO alerting assistance, three locations, four transmissions, five advanced notification, six control operator or operators, seven log submission, eight scoring, nine awards, 10 club scores. There's a lot of detail in this article that begins on page 32 of CQ, June 2009. So if you're one of those many hams that are involved in the CQ Worldwide DX contest in any form whatsoever, you should really get a copy of this issue and or read it or have someone help you to read through it so that you know what goes and what doesn't with the new extreme category. There's an interesting feature in the CQ magazines. Every so often, if not every month, they have a survey that they'd like you to tell them what you think about. I'm going to read to you the results of the March survey, which asked about your QSL-ing practices. QSL is the Q sign for exchanging verifications of contact by the very attractive little postcards, usually. Nearly half of you who responded to the survey, 46%, say the statement that most closely reflects your approach is that you respond 100% to all QSLs you receive. Another 32% say you send QSLs only to stations whose cards you need or who have QSL'd you. And 21% say you QSL all contacts, 100%. In addition, 6% each say you only QSL DX stations or do not QSL at all. 2% respond to QSLs only if they are accompanied by a self-addressed stamped envelope or IRC. And 1% QSL only in response to cards accompanied by, you know what, cash. And the laugh was not printed here, folks. Ask your primary reason for exchanging and or collecting QSLs. 46% of you said it's because they're exciting to receive and fun to look at. I would certainly agree with that. 40% for credit toward operating awards. 25% for a personal record of the people you've contacted. 7% for other reasons. And 4% do not collect or exchange QSLs. Now, the next question asks why you think that fewer hams seem to exchange QSLs today. Close to half of you, 45%, blame the cost of postage. 34% said too little interest. 7% each said costs of printing or that more people operate only on repeaters where nobody QSLs. And 6% each said it was due to people talking only to people they already know and others. Who's others? Asking about online slant electronic QSLing, 56% of you do not participate. 28% of you use the ARRL's logbook of the world, that's LOTW. 26% use EQSL.cc. 2% use single station online QSLing, and 1% use another electronic or online QSL slant logbook exchange. Nevertheless, 50% of you believe electronic slant online QSLing is a reasonable alternative to the high cost of traditional QSLing, while 90% disagree. Another 90% aren't sure, and 10% don't care. I almost said something else, but it wasn't printed here, folks. You know what I mean. Finally, 67% of you use the ARRL's incoming QSL Bureau, or its equivalent, and 55% use the outgoing Bureau. This month's free subscription winner is Joseph Hare, H-A-R-E. His call sign is KC2UDL, and he hopped in from Wallington, New Jersey. Well, talking about hopping, I think I'll hop out to the kitchen for my second cup of dark coffee. It's still a little bit dark here in Massachusetts, the first day of June. You have to get these things done early, so the rest of the things you have to do in this world don't get neglected, if you know what I mean. Let's go to Kids Corner. This is authored by Brittany Decker, called KB1OGL, 10 Ways to Attract Youth to Amateur Radio. A quotation, amateur radio is dying, close quote, or so we sometimes hear. Amateur radio is in fact aging. A solution then is to age it backwards. Focus all of your efforts on raising interest among young people, recruiting them into the hobby and keeping their interest. Soon enough, it will be their turn to worry about amateur radio's aging process, and they will be the ones teaching kids. Here I have come across a survey by Simon Bohm, KCHZYD, to 7 young amateur radio operators. After reading it, I found the facts to be what I suspected was the problem with amateur radio all along, and even some things I didn't expect to see. Below is my list of criticisms and improvements for amateur radio, from least important to most important. Number 10, name change. In the survey, the term ham radio or amateur radio surfaced as a possible problem. This may be something to look into, as this is the first thing kids hear when they learn about radio. A more attractive name could help get more kids into radio, but we don't want to change everything about radio to please the eyes of its next generation of operators. So this may be something to consider, but changing the name probably will not bring youth running to the license exams. Number 9, schools beware. Where is the one place you can count on to have the most kids concentrated in one area? Schools. There will always be youngsters in school, as long as truancy is against the law. Why not use this as an opportunity to educate them in reading, writing, arithmetic, and, of course, radio? Lace the concepts of radio into math, science, history, and geography, and students will be able to relate to radio and refer to their studies through it. It could even be related to writing because, for example, I am writing a story about amateur radio, aren't I? At almost every school, there is at least one teacher who is funny, respected, never has to yell to control his or her classes. When asked what else we could do to get amateur radio into the school system, one kid suggested getting a cool teacher to act as a sort of sponsor for it. This is a great suggestion because not only can the teacher help students learn about radio, but he or she can make it a fun activity. With an awesome teacher, we and the school's support on amateur radio side, we can get kids involved one school at a time. Number 8, world domination. Just kidding. While schools are one of the best places to find kids, amateur radio should not be limited to them. After all, I'm sure there are more enjoyable things than school. Take the Boys and Girls Clubs or Scouting, for example. Amateur radio already has taken root in Boys and Girls Clubs across America. There is one that I know of in Michigan that was mentioned in the last edition of Kids Corner called the DAR Radio Club. Even scouting is amateur radio-oriented activities, such as how to build a radio. Scouting also has orienteering and geocoaching activities, which can translate to fox hunting and APRS, that's Automatic Positioning Reporting System. As for churches and a Salvation Army, many emergency communications organizations work with these groups, using their buildings as places of operation during an emergency, as storage areas for emergency communications equipment, and holding ARIS, Amateur Radio Emergency Service, or Skywarn meetings and classes. The Salvation Army has its own ham radio emergency network, known as Saturn. Number 7. Dude, let's chill today. Along with schools and recreational organizations for amateur radio to really hit home with kids, it must be pal-friendly. Help teenage kids to see that, especially during the bad economy, unlimited text and talk is not as cheap as it used to be, while amateur radio is totally and completely free after investing in a radio. What a sick, nasty hobby to take up when parents are ragging on them for the last phone bill. Although a radio can have a heavy price also, they shouldn't need the latest and greatest technology in the amateur radio world. An HD can do the trick if all they want to do is chat with friends. Don't like to talk? How about text? Ham radio gives a completely free alternative to this also. RTTY resembles instant messenger, but it is really a cross between IM and texting. This is a completely free alternative to texting and is just as fast. There is also another method available that is proven to be faster than texting, CW, also known as Morse code. There is a problem of youngsters learning and memorizing Morse code, but it's not much different from learning all the texting abbreviations, right? Right. Number 6, when all else fails. Charity work appeals to people of all sorts and ages. Kids involved in the Salvation Army may also stumble upon amateur radio through emergency communications. Organizations such as ARIS and Skywarn have roots throughout the Salvation Army and hold meetings and classes in Salvation Army buildings. They collaborate with the Salvation Army during times of emergency, and while most volunteers provide food and other items, the amateur radio operators obviously provide communications. Many kids are also connected to the police or fire stations in their city in some way. A parent could be a police officer or firefighter. These people also need the means of communication, and especially during an emergency are responsible for maintaining communication throughout a city. Moving down to number 5, Hamfest it up. In the survey, the subject of Hamfest came up. I have been to a couple of Hamfests. During the Hamfest, my dad and I walked around and looked at stuff while standing in the hot sun. At the time, I probably was wishing I was in the pool, but I think my dad was enjoying it. I do have to admit that I saw some interesting things and met a couple of people, but only 4 people who were near my age. To sum it up, I saw 3 major problems with Hamfest: youth attendance, youth-oriented activities, and energy. Now, number 4, the quality time with the family. I'm sure that although most people in amateur radio may act like family to one another, they all don't live together. It can be assumed then that the best people to operate with are your family members. Take a family board game night to the ham shack instead and play around on a radio. In addition to a bedtime story, ask some radio Q&A to study for the amateur radio exam. There are so many ham-related activities that a family can do together and at the same time form stronger bonds and wonderful memories that will last a lifetime. Besides that, I know from experience that it is easier to study for your amateur radio exam if you have an older, more knowledgeable person to help you. However, I also know from experience that it is difficult to get the entire family license, such as the families in the December issue of Kids Corner. Whatever you end up doing together as a family with amateur radio, it is almost certainly going to be a fun time. Number 3, scholarships. Even if amateur radio operators succeed in educating kids in the existence of radio, we can never get all of them motivated enough to get a license with the sole argument that it is a rewarding hobby. Instead, we should give specific examples. A major motivator for kids in their late teens who are getting ready to go off to college is the allure of scholarships, especially in this time of economic recession. College isn't getting any cheaper, and kids need all the help they can get with scholarships. and radio. There are so many scholarships that go unclaimed, all because no one knows about them. If anything, tell kids to get licensed for their future, because amateur radio can be rewarding in many, many ways. Number two, calling all clubs. Of the topics that were brought up by the kids for discussion, one of the most prominent was ham radio clubs. Although the majority of kids attended club meetings regularly and generally liked going to them, they found some room for improvement in the favor of young amateurs. Regarding clubs, the kids surveyed agreed on three main aspects of how the clubs could improve. They agreed that clubs should have less of a boring business meeting, try harder to recruit youth into the club, and once they succeed in getting youth involved, give them something to do. Now, number one, the best way. Get them involved. Recognize their potential. Inspire them. And give them stuff to do. The final and best way to get more young people involved is to give them meaningful work. What happens many times when a young person shows interest in radio is that once they experience that first peak of interest in it, they are left idling like a car that has been started but left in neutral. My suggestion is that the older amateurs be the drivers. Your job is to take charge and direct the youth into amateur radio. Remember that this isn't the speedway. You are not trying to scare kids away. It's more like your first trip in the brand new car. He's out of the driveway and take it nice and easy the first few times. In other words, don't immediately rush into Q&A for the technician exam. Get the kids some experience on the radio operating under a legal call sign and make sure they have some kind of fundamental education based on personal experience. Then start with the intense study sessions for technician general and maybe even extra at some point. Once this has been accomplished, get them involved in a club. This is the time when it becomes the club's responsibility to drive the car. The club members need to make sure that the young members are actively participating in events. Refer to them during club meetings. Ask them if they would like to help out if an extra pair of hands is needed. Basically, show them that you trust and believe in them. What I would like to see among the older generation of amateurs is a more active role in youngsters' progression through the radio world. Hopefully, I've provided some insight into what needs to be done. The rest is up to you. Drivers, start your engines. So there you have it. Follow this guide, and I'm sure amateur radio will be teeming with new young amateurs. Remember, this information was taken directly from young amateurs, so it cannot be ignored. 73, Brittany, KB1OGL. Folks, I want to give you a heads up on the 2009 CQ Worldwide VHF contest. It starts at 1800 Universal Time Constant, UTC, Saturday, July 18, 2009. Ends 2100 UTC, Sunday, July 19, 2009. Now, regarding the contest period, 27 hours for all stations, all categories. Operate any portion of the contest period you wish. As far as the objectives are concerned, the objectives of this contest are for amateurs around the world to contact as many amateurs as possible in the contest period to promote VHF, very high frequency, to allow VHF operators the opportunity to experience the enhanced propagation available at this time of year, and for interested amateurs to collect VHF Maidenhead grid locators for award credits. Regarding the bands to be operated upon, all authorized amateur radio frequencies on 50 megahertz, that's 6 meters, and 144 megahertz, which is 2 meters, may be used as authorized by local law and license class. So get ready for the 2009 CQ Worldwide VHF contest, starting at 1800 UTC, Saturday, July 18, 2009, ending the next day, 2100 UTC, Sunday, July 19, 2009. Well, that brings me just about up to time for the digest format reading of CQ Magazine for June 2009. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York. which regarding the production of the Courage Handyham system, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address, law lowercase, handyham, one word, handyham@courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH, or geographic location, we're about 50 miles south of Boston, right on Buzzards Bay, near New Bedford, and good old Cape Cod. Thanks a lot for listening along again. If you'd like to email me with any comments, criticisms, suggestions, or recommendations, I'd love to hear from you. My email address is n1blf@comcast.net. Thanks a lot for listening along again on the Courage Handyham System, 7388.